I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:19 on Thursday, January 22nd, 2026, and we're here in room 120. Please remember to silence your cell phones today. Members present include Representative St. Clair. Welcome to the House State Affairs Committee. Representative Vance, Representative Holland, Representative Himshute, Vice Chair Story, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Additionally, our record secretary today is Cecilia Miller with Andy Magnuson. Thank you for being here. And our moderator from the Juno LIO is Zach Lawhorn. Our committee aide for today's hearing is Stuart Relay. So on today's agenda, we have two items. We are taking up House Bill 133 on payment of contracts from Representative Himshute's office. And following that continuation of last year's work, we will have an introductory hearing today on House Bill 124 related to the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority from my office, which had gotten way backlogged on the queue last year, and so we're finally bringing that one up starting out this session. So to start out today, our first item is House Bill 133 on payment of contracts from Representative Himshute. The House State Affairs Committee heard this bill twice last year towards the end of session. For members' information, the plan today is to roll out and adopt a committee substitute as our working document, which has just a few technical changes in it. And then after that CS has been adopted, to do a reintroduction of the bill for the sponsor and staff. So just for members' info, we're gonna make a motion to have the committee substitute be adopted as the working document, present the summary of changes, which are technical in nature, and then go back through a reintroduction of the bill. Vice Chair Story, can I get a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the House State Affairs Committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 133, also known as 34-LS0114/L, as our working document.
And thank you, Vice Chair Story. I'm going to object to ask our committee aide, Stuart Relay, to approach the table and present our summary of changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. For the record, Stuart Relay, staff for Representative Carrick. Madam Chair, there are two changes in version L of House Bill 133. This CS deletes what was Section 2 in the previous version of the bill. That was an unnecessary conforming change, and then it renumbers the sections accordingly. There are no changes to the other sections except for the last section, which is the effective date. It changes it from January 1, 26 to January 1, 2027.
And just for clarification, is it January or July?
Sorry. Yes. Correct. Thank you, Madam Chair. July 1, 26 to July 1, 27.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for the committee substitute? I'm a little rusty at this, so I think we're doing all right. Representative St. Clair.
Madam Chair, L version is what you said? I'm sorry. I'm trying to get my notes organized.
Yes, that's right, Representative St. Clair. We're looking at version / L. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, I wonder, I'm quickly trying to reread the original Section 2 that has been, I understand, removed with this CS. Can you restate or clarify the impact of taking this out? It sounded like maybe it was a technical change, but as I read this section, it's talking about some I think some interest on that. I'm just trying to clarify, is this technical in that maybe this is picked up someplace else, so this was unnecessary, or is this making a change? I'm not completely clear. on the impact of removing Section 2 and just want to be a little clearer about it.
Yeah, we're bringing up staff for Representative Himshute. If you want to put yourself on the record and address that question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ella Lubin, staff to Representative Himshute, and through the chair to Representative Holland, thank you for your question. Section 2, amended current statute, which regards private contractors for public works projects. Sorry, sometimes it's a tongue twister for me. And we have decided not to amend current statute at this time.
Okay, thank you.
And so I'm going to correct my earlier statement that it's just technical changes, because that is just a little bit of a different policy change. But are there any other questions regarding the committee substitute from the committee members? Okay. I'm going to remove my objection to adopting this committee substitute. And hearing no objection, the committee substitute /L has been adopted as our working document. And so with the committee substitute now before us, I'd like to offer an opportunity for Representative Himshute to reintroduce the bill alongside her staff. And since we are starting this new session today, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Carrick. I'm Rebecca Himshute. I represent House District 2, Yakutat to Heidelberg, 21 communities on the coast of Southeast Alaska. This bill is I'm calling it a good governance bill. What we're doing with this bill is making the state of Alaska a good partner to municipalities, tribes, and nonprofits in the same way that we're a good partner to private contractors who are working with the state to meet the needs of Alaskans. So much of the work that's done by tribes, nonprofits, and municipalities is done to some degree on behalf of the state. Some of the work that we can't get to, choose not to do, or work simply that enriches the lives of Alaskans happens through those entities. Right now, if the state is late in the payment of grant funding to those entities, there's no harm to the state and a lot of harm to the tribes, the municipalities, and the nonprofits. Those folks often work on a very, very narrow margin. Nonprofit says a whole lot right there, right? So they're using the funds they have to meet their mission, not to bankroll, not to have money set aside. So when we're late with our payment as a state, the harm to them can be immense, including having to close their doors for a period of time, including having to stop their services for a period of time. So to make us a better partner and to make their work more functional, we're seeking to provide parity between the nonprofits, the tribes, the municipalities, and our private contractors.
And we'll open it up for questions on House Bill 133. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Himshute, sorry, my...
It's all good.
A little slow on the draw today. I know that you've had conversations with the administration about how they could shorten up this timeline. Mm-hmm. Do you have any updates on what they can do to meet this objective?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, it's different in every agency. A couple of agencies are on time right now. A couple of agencies are in arrears by 60 to 90 days. It's everything from we need more technology to we need more training on the technology to we need more personnel. The reasons are different across the board. For those who are making it on time, we've looked at what are your practices, what are you doing that makes this work? And it often is a low pass-through environment where they just don't have the volume that you would have, say, in the Department of Administration or Department of Health. So that helps. Did you want to add to that? Okay.
Follow up. So I'm vaguely reminding myself about what this policy would do. Do you feel that this bill would be more effective in getting those changes versus allocating them more specific to those departments, the needs to help them get things moved along?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Vance. What this bill does is give them standing, so to speak. So every year through our budget process, we attempt to give the agencies what they ask for, which is not always consistent with what they need. And we have found that that inconsistency is not in this administration or the previous administration. It's in every administration. And so what we want to do is provide the 10% penalty that we give to contractors, private contractors right now, also to nonprofits, tribes, and municipalities to give them the standing if they needed to take action.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up?
I can see the mechanism of why, but the catch here is that this would be the 10% punitive on the executive branch, but the executive branch is one who enforces the law. So how do you see, if there was a complaint, how do you see this being resolved?
Thank you for the question through the chair, Representative Vance. It remains to be seen. We've asked for examples of this from the private sector, and as you can imagine, a lot of private sector folks are not wanting to talk a whole lot about problems they've had with the state because it might harm their standing in getting future contracts. It's been difficult to get the information for what's happening now. And so the enforceability of it, we can't enforce a statute that we don't have. So I'm asking to put the statute in place, and then we will see how it gets enforced. My guess, I speculate, that a number of groups would come together and bring potentially a case to the state rather than an individual. Like the Boys and Girls Club of Wasilla, they're not going to probably, I mean, potentially they could say, hey, you haven't paid us on time and we are now due this. And in theory, the state would say, you're correct and we owe you that, whatever amount. The goal would be that everybody gets paid on time. So the idea is let's figure out what's not happening and make it happen so that this is never needed. And then if they had to, as a group, come together and say one voice wasn't enough, but now we're all going to come together under this statute. But right now, without a statute, there's nothing they can do.
Thank you.
Representative St. Clair.
Through the chair. How are you doing, Representative?
It's great to see you.
Good. I have a bunch of questions. I asked a couple. You sat down with me before floor session this morning, and we talked about a couple.
Rep St. Clair, really quick, could you just make sure to talk into the mic for the recording?
Yes, ma'am.
Sorry about that. Thank you.
That's okay. That's okay. We spoke this morning on a couple of things, and just to refer back to Representative Vance's comment, if we don't know how we're going to enforce it, isn't that kind of bringing the cart before the horse? We should have some idea on whether we are going to the interest, are we going to fine the executive branch? Are we going to fine the department, the department head? I mean, there's you're trying to put teeth in this, and I understand and I respect that. However, you don't really have a lot of teeth as of right now.
Yeah, the penalty through the chair. Thank you, Representative St. Clair. It's great to have you here. The penalty is assessed from the state of Alaska, so I don't know if that's the agency or the executive branch, like the governor herself or himself. I can't say who actually pays it, but the state would be responsible. So whoever pays when the state pays is who would have to pay.
Okay. Follow-up?
I'm not sure that answers your question.
It does and it doesn't, okay. but it gives me a clear picture of what we're talking about. Do we have anyone from grants online or anything like that that can answer some questions pertaining to number of grants, total amounts?
Representative St. Clair, we don't today. Oh, maybe we do today.
Apologies. Can I just clarify as well, Chair Carrick? I apologize. It does say here on page 3, I'm a little rusty myself.
That's okay.
If online... It starts on line 2. If a nonprofit organization, municipality, or Alaska Native organization is not paid as required by A of this section, the agency shall pay interest on the unpaid amount. But as you're aware, the agency gets their funding from our process
from us,
here.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
So we're all getting
okay, but
put on the hot
that
seat.
Does clear it up on who has to pay. And I apologize, Madam Chair. I'm trying to. I'm new at this.
It's okay. We're all a little rusty this afternoon.
And we do have someone here from an agency if that's helpful.
Okay. That might actually be helpful. Let's take a very brief at ease just to kind of get a sense of what would be helpful for this conversation. At ease. House State Affairs is back on the record. Thank you, Hannah Lager, for hopping in the hot seat here. If you could put your name on the record and if you'd like to respond to Representative St. Clair's question.
Absolutely. Thank you. My name is Hannah Lager. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development.
And maybe it would help, Representative St. Clair, if you could restate that question.
Through the chair, how many grants annually does the state put out, roughly? I know you. It varies by year, but roughly.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative St. Clair, I can only speak to the portion that the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development issues, but I would say we are usually in the hundreds range. Occasionally, in a high year or certainly during the pandemic, we issued more than hundreds. But typically, it's hundreds. I will say the majority of the grants that are issued by the Department of Commerce fall under grants to named recipients or grants to municipalities, which are specifically excluded from this legislation in Section 2, at the end of Section 2. So it would affect a small portion of our grant portfolio.
Follow-up?
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. Through the chair, can you give me a ballpark number on how much in grants? And I know you're just DCCED, but how much in grants and kind of layered, because there's a threshold within this legislation, and I want to see if it goes over or under. It makes reference to another piece of statute that puts a limit, and I don't know if it's under or over. Section Alaska Statute 4545010. It says in Bravo, and I don't really understand that you're not going to find it on there. It just makes reference to it. I'm trying to figure out if this is above or below. It says a contractor loan committed in the principal amount exceeds $25,000 is exempt from the limitations of this subsection. Does that mean it doesn't apply?
Through the chair, Representative St. Clair, not having that piece in front of me, I can't quite interpret that. But what I will say is most of our grants are over $25,000, the vast majority
of them
that we issue. We try to make them substantive going out to communities.
And you said that...
Follow-up.
Apologize. Follow-up through the chair. And how many of DCCED's... grants would be impacted by this legislation, roughly?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative St. Clair, that would vary year to year. A lot of the grants that we give out really do, they're appropriated by the legislature, so we issue what is appropriated. Our grant portfolio currently is somewhere just north of $1 billion, so we do have a number of grants out there that are receiving regular payments. As far as the individual number of grants, I don't have that handy, but we can tell from this that it would apply to National Petroleum Reserve grants. It would apply to grants to unincorporated communities, and then, of course, payments to vendors that we make as part of our normal ongoing day-to-day operations.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up?
I promise. Through the chair, you made a comment of earlier of how many of your grants would be impacted by this legislation. I didn't catch that number.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Representative St. Clair, I don't have an exact number because it does vary year to year, but the vast majority of the grants that we issue are under the grants to municipalities or grants to named recipients, which are not affected by this legislation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for hopping in the hot seat there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do we have additional questions on House Bill 133? Vice Chair Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, Rep. Hemshoot and Ms. Lieben. I'm wondering, in your talking with people, it's no secret that we are short-staffed in all of our agencies. Have you ever thought about, and it's no secret that we want to be responsible, a state where we pay our bills in a timely manner. Have you thought about if the 30 days was 45 days, what impact that would have on the recipient, and would that make it so that we are more apt to be timely?
Thank you for the question through the chair, Representative Story. I think we have not talked about doing 45 days because the goal is parity. We're trying to make this a level playing field for both private contractors and for nonprofits, tribes, and municipalities.
Through the chair, Representative Story, Ella Lubin, staff to Rep. Hemshute. Additionally, some agencies are already making that 30-day deadline, and if we raise the deadline to 45 days, it would increase the time for those grants and contracts that are being reimbursed.
Follow up.
Thank you for that information through the chair. So do we have an idea of the current contracts that we have, the amount of cost we are paying in interest to the ones that we are not doing a timely payment system to?
Through the chair, Representative Story, it's been very difficult to get any information on that from the agency side, which would mostly be DOT for private contractors, but from the contractor side, once again, a lot of contractors don't really want to rock the boat because that, I think, concerns them in terms of future contracts, so competitiveness and they don't want a black mark on their name. So we've struggled to get that information.
Follow up. I would think that in our legislative audit books or in our agency, that documentation would be there, that there would be a category that says arrears, payments. I don't know if – anyway, that would be my question for the auditor maybe, where we would find that information.
That's a great question. Thank you, through the chair.
Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. As we begin to learn about the new health care – Rural Healthcare Transformation Act. I think I got that almost in the right order, but I hope I'm close enough. I'm just curious, as you look at that significant amount of new funding that I expect will probably show up in the form of many new grants and contracts, what we might have learned from the rapid deployment of money during the COVID years that might teach us something about what is likely to happen with this rural transformation funding. And where I'm really going is, as we look at this bill and its effect, hopefully to strengthen our nonprofits' ability to be able to do the work we need them to do, particularly in this area, do you have any thoughts, and maybe this is an open-ended question to come back to, about how this can be used to help make sure that that rural healthcare funding coming through quickly is going to be used and will be done in a way that our nonprofits that we depend upon will be more successful than they might have been if we hopefully avoid some of the challenges in the COVID area. So sorry, I kind of layered on a couple of thoughts there, but if you've got any thoughts there, or maybe we can come back to it. But just watching for our success with this new money, and this, to me, really interacts with that capability.
Thank you, Representative Holland, through the chair. I would just comment that $272 million infusion into rural health, as a rural person myself, is something I'm really excited about. I would like to have this in place before that funding starts to flow so that we can make sure that the folks who are charged with making the best use of that funding are able to do it in a timely way, and that we give those funds that we have for 5 years, that we give those funds their best chance at success that we can. And I think having something like this in place gives us a better chance of making sure that that work happens timely.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. This raises a question and kind of a statement. You mentioned that, Representative Hemshute, you mentioned that DOT was one of the departments that's not been as timely, which obviously they have so many contracts out there. We know the health department has so many contracts, and we have heard that a lot of doctors don't want to work with the state because they've been so slow in getting payments out there. In your inquiries about finding out the nexus of the problems, have you heard anything about the movement of federal money? Because in both of those departments, it's a large percentage is federal dollars, and we know that certain pots of money have to be distributed a certain way by a certain time. And I just want to know, are we fully understanding where the crux of the problem is in these delays and helping get to the root of the problem? Because with this rural health money, we want to make sure that we're doing that adequately and helping, giving our departments the tools that they need. This is one component that you're trying to help motivate them internally, but what else is there? Is the federal side of the dollars and the timing that comes that doesn't align with our calendar, is that a part of the problem?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, my understanding, and I want to be really clear, DOT, as far as I know, I don't know how much they work with nonprofits. The issue there is with private contractors. And so with the Rural Health Transformation Funding, Department of Health, that kind of thing, my understanding is nothing is awarded until the state has the funding, and then the award is given, and then the clock ticks. Am I correct about that? We can confirm. I remember a conversation where that was my understanding, but I want to make sure that I'm right about that. You know, I'll come back to you if I'm not right.
Yes. Thank you.
And I put myself in the queue here. Last session when we were discussing this bill, we had asked some of the departments what the challenges are to submitting payments within the 30-day time frame right now. And they cited things like low staffing, high turnover, low institutional knowledge just generally in the departments. There was at least one department that has only one form of grant award software, and that was a challenge for them. And they have an internal need in some of our departments to streamline services. So I'm just sort of curious. I think I have an opinion on this answer, but do you see pursuit of prompt payment as a way to also improve some of our own internal state governance systems when it comes to distribution within our departments, and a way to essentially open the door to some cleanup on how we currently process payments?
Thank you for the question, Chair Carrick. I will say I think it's Department of Administration who had the most timely – no. There was one department that was timely, and we asked them, what are you doing? What's working for you? And how can we replicate that? And they had some ideas, but it did seem like making one grant payment system that's used in every department is done in other states and could be helpful here. So some standardization would really help across all agencies. And so I think some of those answers are out there, and I think this is, I hope, a driver for those, what do I want to call it? It's not extra. It's what we should be doing with the public dollar. We should be as efficient as we can be with the public dollar. And so it's not extra to become efficient and effective in the delivery of the grants and that kind of thing. And so, yes, I think if I'm answering your question correctly, the idea is this will push us to do a better job.
Thank you for that. Sort of a loaded question, because I believe that that's one of the benefits of this legislation. But further questions, Representative St. Clair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I only got one or two more left for you, Representative, and then
if we could
go back to DCCED, found a question further down. But through the chair, Representative Hemschut, I'm a budget guy. I'm a fiscal guy. I looked at the broke down DCCED, DOH, and DMVA, how much they anticipated they would have to pay in their fiscal notes. Breaking that down even further, I broke it down to how much of it is UGF. But where are we going to find, I mean, it's only $1.3 million, but how would you fund this?
Through the chair, I would ask on behalf of the municipalities, the tribes, and the nonprofits who've been awarded a grant, what are they supposed to do? So I think we have to figure it out. If we're the ones giving the money out, we should be on time.
Oh, through the chair.
Follow up.
I agree wholeheartedly. However, as a budget person, won't this increase their budgets? if it increases their budgets because now they have to pay out. We did establish that it is the agencies and not the governor. If the agency has to pay out, where's that money going to come from? They're going to come back to the state and ask for it, or the administration or whatever. So how do we increase their budgets to cover this interest payment? It's not large. It's not huge. I think they could probably absorb it. However, well, you're kind of giving the same look I'm thinking, that the fiscal notes might be off a little bit. How, and I apologize, Madam Chair, for going around in circles. Where do we get the money to give to the agencies to pay out interest?
Through the chair. The goal is to not have to pay out interest. That's the purpose of the bill. And then I just want to be really clear. I don't think that the state employees in these agencies are doing their work poorly. I don't hold the responsibility on the employees. I hold the responsibility on the working conditions that they've been provided. For example, not having the technology they need, not having standardized technology, not having the training they need, and the high rate of turnover in the state. So there's no blame to lay on any of the agencies or the people in the agencies. The idea is for us to clean up our act. So where will the money come from? My goal is that we do not need to pay any, not even 1 cent. We don't have those anymore. Not even one dime of penalty.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Holland? Oh, never mind. Not in the queue.
That was a drink of coffee, not a...
looking around for additional questions. Representative St. Clair?
Madam Chair, I would like to have DCC come back up. I will get with Representative Himshute offline.
And I will look forward to it.
Conversation.
Welcome back, Ms. Lager. And if you'd like to put yourself on the record, but I'll ask Representative St. Clair to ask his question.
Through the chair, in one of the responses that came back from DCCED, it stated that there was software that you all were trying to get and put in place. Can you give us a status report on that?
Absolutely. Thank you. Through the chair, my name is Hannah Lager. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Through the chair to Representative St. Clair, I am very pleased to say that we have rolled out our new grant software. So that means that new grant applications, new applicants, communities applying for grants in the Division of Community and Regional Affairs can apply online. Those grant notices are published online, and when it gets to processing payments, that is, the status report is uploaded into that system, it gets handed over to our fiscal team who picks it up electronically, loads documents in, it automatically then shoots over into our financial system for just a last certification, and then the payment goes out.
Follow up? Just one. Do you know of, I know you can only speak for DCCED, do you know of any other agencies that are using similar or the same software? And if you don't know, just say you're not sure. I'm not going to hold your feet to the fire on it.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative St. Clair, I believe there are other agencies that do have some variety of grant software. The one that we chose for the department through a procurement process was pretty specific for the type of grants we do, so I'm not familiar with other grant
okay.
systems.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming back forward. Looking around to see if there are additional questions on House Bill 133. And seeing none at this time, do want to just remind members that we did have a couple of hearings on this legislation in the previous session, and to please refer back as well to the conversations and the questions that were there. At this time, we are going to set an amendment deadline for House Bill 133 for Wednesday, January 28th at 5 p.m. I know there are potentially a couple amendments being drafted. If anyone has difficulty meeting that schedule with Ledge Legal, please let our office know as soon as possible. And at this time, we are setting House Bill 133 aside. Thank you, Representative Himshute and staff. The next and last item on the agenda today is an introduction of House Bill 124 from my office. Just as a note for committee members, this is just an introductory hearing on House Bill 124, also known as the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, Accountability Act. This hearing is meant to just provide an intro to the bill itself and offer an opportunity for members to put initial questions out. wanted to note that next week we will be hearing directly from the ADA Executive Director and potentially other ADA staff to further answer questions and offer an opportunity for additional discussion. So at this time, we are going to take a brief at ease to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Story. At ease.
We are back on the record. We are going to be hearing House Bill 124. It's now before us. Representative Owen, welcome. Rep. McKay, I'm glad to see you here. Rep. Carrick, before you proceed with your presentation, I just wanted to let committee members know that Sherry Bowman is over here. If we need any assistance, well, Mr. Relay is up front. Thank you, Sherry, or thank you, Ms. Bowman, for doing that. And I wanted to let people know that I talked to the bill sponsor, and she's fine to ask questions as we go along. However, if it gets long, I might just have her get through the presentation and make sure we finish that. So, again, please proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story and members of the State Affairs Committee. Really pleased to finally be able to bring forward House Bill 124, also known as the ADA Accountability Act, or more simply ADA. Just for the record, Representative Ashley Carrick, West Fairbanks, House District 35. And today the plan is to have an introductory hearing. Just want to introduce what House Bill 124 is and what it would do. And then again, just for members' information and the public listening, the intention will be to hear from ADA at our very next hearing. I will note that ADA has also provided a large number of backup documents, which are available for members, and hope that folks have a chance to take a look at those as well. So to get started, just want to offer a very, very brief history of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA. ADA has a mission of promoting, developing, and advancing economic growth and diversification in Alaska by providing various means of financing and investment. It was established in 1967 to help provide these economic opportunities in our state and also to provide employment opportunities. And over the 60 years that ADA has been in existence, there's been a cumulative economic impact of $55.4 billion and a creation of over 13,000 jobs. So one thing that you'll hear me state potentially in response to questions is this bill about getting rid of ADA or harming ADA? No. Truly, my intent with this legislation is trying to strike a balance between the many constituents and Alaskans I've heard from that would like to simply get rid of ADA and have them not exist anymore, and have the current broad brushstroke and large breadth that ADA currently has under its authority as a corporation. So this bill is attempting to strike that balance, and I think it's worth recognizing the real and vast economic impact that ADA has had in our state since its creation. In creating economic development. This next slide shows just a few ADA projects and loans. There's obviously many, many more, but just wanted to show a small number of projects that are under $10 million and a few that are over $50 million, just as some examples. We can see that some of the under $10 million examples might be ones that many in the public have never heard of before. They're smaller scale projects, everything ranging from working on the Blood Bank of Alaska in Anchorage to Island Air Service in Kodiak to the Big Lake Lions Club receiving a small amount of funding there in Big Lake. But these have had some real economic benefits for the communities affected. The projects listed here, over $50 million, are also spanning a gambit. Projects that include the Interior Energy Project, which has been hugely impactful to the Fairbanks community and costing approximately $139 million for ADA in Fairbanks. Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation funding, as well as what I would call more controversial projects in the public and in the media, such as the Ambler Access Project and not listed on here, but West Sioux Access Project being another major development project that Ada is pursuing. So again, the purpose of House Bill 124 is just to strike a balance between Ada's mission for having economic development in Alaska while also enhancing legislative and public oversight of Ada as a state corporation. I want to recognize as well that other state corporations in Alaska don't necessarily have the kind of oversight that is in House Bill 124. I would also counter that argument, why wouldn't they be included, with noting that Ada's scope is for economic development and job creation and has a broader scope and a broader community impact in a lot of cases than other state corporations. And so I do see them as a bit fundamentally different, although the issues may be the same. And to be honest, I would consider legislation on other state-owned corporations to the same oversight capacity in the future. But the goal of this legislation is focused on Ada, and it's to help them focus on especially those smaller and more localized economic development projects while still allowing larger projects the opportunity to move forward once they've included broader stakeholder engagement and potentially legislative authorization. We've essentially covered what's on slide five, but really we're trying to help juxtapose the public backlash that has existed in some cases for Ada with the desire to have Ada move forward and continue to provide the results for Alaskans. And at this time, I wanted to turn it over to my staff, Stuart Relay, to walk through a sectional analysis. I also just want to note that in your packets, members do also have a white paper, which takes the sectional and turns that into a one-pager. And that's more or less what we will be going over with the sectional today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Story for the record, Stuart Relay, staff for Representative Carrick. The sectional analysis is as follows. excuse me. Section 1 establishes the short title is the Ada Accountability Act. Section 2 amends AS 4488030 alpha relating to the Ada Board. It requires legislative confirmation for board members. It increases the size of the board from 7 to 9 members. It designates one board member, one board seat for someone representing an environmental advocacy organization. And it adds two board members, one of them appointed by the Speaker of the House and another one of them appointed by the President of the Senate. Section 3 amends AS 4488030 Charlie, also relating to the Ada Board. It includes conforming language relating to the increased board size. It increases the length of board terms from 2 to 3 years. It prohibits governors from removing board members. Section 4 requires the Ada Board to establish a personnel policy and minimum qualifications for the executive director. Section 5 is conforming language relating to Section 14. Section 6 requires Ada to adopt regulations by passing a resolution. On the next slide here, Section 7 amends AS 4488085 Delta relating to public engagement with the Ada Board. Specifically, it requires it increases public notice requirements, requiring 30-day public notices for board meetings. It requires the board to give each testifier at least 2 minutes for their testimony. It requires the board to publish written responses to public comments. It requires the board to publish a written justification when they adopt, amend, or repeal regulations. Section 8 adds a new section, 4488107, capping the size of the Ada Revolving Fund and all of its sub-funds to $500 million. Section 9 is a larger section. Adds a new section, AS 4488179, requiring the following actions to be taken for all projects over $10 million. Approval must from a municipality or borough must be provided if the project is within their boundaries. The following findings must be published relating to a project that it is economically advantageous. The project applicant is financially responsible. Addresses concerns about demand on public roadways and facilities relating to a project, employment projections and data, that the project is economically and financially feasible, and that the project is legal. Additionally, it requires a report to be produced about projected economic, social, and environmental effects of the project, host a public hearing of the project, submit a report to the legislature that includes all the documents related to findings required by the section, and gain approval from the legislature by law. Section 10 prohibits ADA board members from voting on measures in which they have an indirect ownership interest. Sections 11 through 12 update annual reporting requirements to the legislature. Section 11 specifies that ADA's annual report is due to the legislature on January 10. This is a conforming change. This January 10th date is already in law. Section 11 is simply conforming changes. Section 12 requires ADA to develop performance metrics, and those metrics must be included in the annual report. The metrics include job creation, industry growth, financial and technical assistance provided to state businesses, and private investment increases. Section 12 also requires an annual report to include the findings of ADA's annual audit, and it requires the annual report to include a summary of all actions taken at all board meetings. Section 13 requires ADA to be subject to the Alaska Public Records Act. Section 14 requires the Attorney General to approve all lawsuits pursued by ADA. If the AG approves a lawsuit, the legislature must be notified. It's important to note that approval is not required if ADA is sued. Section 15 repeals AS 4488380, providing immunity for ADA employees for damages for acts done while performing the duties of their position. Section 16 are transitional measures relating to the appointment of new board members. The terms of board members, excepting the two commissioners that are on the board, expire when the legislature confirms at least two of the governor's new appointees. The term lengths for newly appointed ADA board members appointed by the governor after the effective date of the act are as follows, and it's important to note that these are for the public members. Two members will get one-year terms, two members will get two-year terms, one member will get a three-year term. And it requires the Speaker and the President to appoint board members on or before the 30th day of the 35th legislature. And previous board members are not prohibited from serving on the board. And finally, Section 17 establishes the effective date of January 1, 2027. That, Madam Chair, is the sectional analysis.
Thank you for that presentation. I'm going to turn to committee members. And do we have any questions today? Rep. McCabe.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story. What did ADA do to make you so mad? This is, I would say that this is not a minor adjustment to ADA. This rips the guts out of a program that we designed to, and frankly puts it under the supervision of the legislature. Why should we be micromanaging ADA from, I mean, we can't even manage our budget half the time. Why should we try to micromanage ADA?
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, you know, I might counter that that this is just, you know, essentially dissolving any capacity for ADA to do their work. A lot of the reforms in this legislation are broad and they're sweeping, but a lot of them are also for the public's benefit, not just for our benefit as a legislature. So there's the oversight components, but there's also components such as having timely public notice requirements, allowing for public testimony requirements, for regulation changes, and submitting the board for the Public Records Act. In other words, there's components of the legislation that are meant also for the public's benefit, because the work that ADA does is ultimately for the public's benefit.
Follow up. Weren't they one of the only of the five or six of our public corporations? They were the only one to return a dividend to the state last year, $20 million. Is that right?
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, they did return a dividend, and they are the only one that did so. I would note that historically, over the last number of years, they have returned a low dividend, considering the range that is available to them for returning a dividend. And I don't want to comment on their specific investment decisions and economic factors that led to that distribution, but part of the point here, too, is we want to continue that and have it be as effective as it has been and more effective. So on the one hand, you could look at this as eliminating their capacity to do the work to produce the dividend. On the other hand, you could look at this as a mechanism for us to be a little bit more involved in their governance, therefore allowing for even more development and better decision making for communities. So it's two different ways to kind of approach the same question.
Thanks. Yeah, I we'll probably get all this when they come to visit us. I'm sure we have a chance to ask them questions and flesh this out a little bit, so I won't beat you up anymore.
Rep Holland.
Great. Thanks. I have, I think, primarily just a clarifying question for the moment on the sectional analysis, and then later I want to come back to some different questions regarding the impact of this. But the clarifying question for the moment through the vice chair is on section 9, two elements there. I'm just curious if you could expand on a little bit. One is easy, one may be something that takes a little more follow-up. On the findings related to a project, I'm assuming, but could you clarify that part of the findings that would be important through municipalities or boroughs is compliance with comprehensive plans that would be applicable to that jurisdiction in there? I think that's straightforward. The second clarifying question on Section 9 is, I wonder if you could comment on how you anticipate the impact of the approval required by the legislature on these larger projects. How might that affect AIDA being able to, in a timely manner, be able to develop projects and seek approval in order to proceed with those projects? I expect you've thought through that. But, you know, we meet once a year. That might have an effect. So comp plans, I'm assuming, are there, but just clarify it. And then the process of that legislative approval process, how would that affect our big projects? Thanks.
Through the chair to Representative Holland, you know, I don't see in these points in the legislation where we're specifically addressing comprehensive planning efforts from municipalities. I also just note that many of our communities affected by some of AIDA's largest projects don't have municipal governance. And so when this legislation says address concerns related to demand on public roadways and facilities and have economically advantageous, I would hope that whatever the local governance structure is in a community would be consulted for part of having this more involved, engaged public process. But it would certainly be open to making that language clearer, that it should include those local governance structures in some way as part of the consultation. The second question you asked, you might have to restate. I might have forgotten it already.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm just curious about the last bullet. It says gain approval from the legislature by law on these large projects. Oh, I'm just wondering, how have you thought about how that might impact AIDA being able to process large projects in a timely manner, given the process by which we meet once a year and the time frame of our due diligence on legislation that could take that? How would that, thoughts on how that would work?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Holland, it's a great question, and I think really substantively it's the biggest question, policy question for this piece of legislation is, at what threshold do we set that legislative approval in order to ensure that AIDA is able to do its work in a timely fashion, but that projects over a size that the legislature determines that we have decided qualify as quote unquote large projects are receiving that additional level of approval and oversight. So $10 million is where the legislation is currently set at for a quote-unquote large project. I think there could be a lot of different interpretations of what qualifies as a large project. And therefore, the number of projects that would be captured through that process in a short time frame. You know, it's my intent that a project the size of West Sioux or Ambler Road or other very large development projects, even ones that I have a lot of constituents and a lot of strong supporters for, such as the interior gas build-out in the Fairbanks area. That is a $139 million project. In my mind, that is a very large project. But I think there could be different interpretations of how we strike a balance between where we require legislative approval and how it would affect timelines on ADA's projects. We definitely want ADA to be able to strike while the iron is hot within reason.
Thank you. Rep. Hemshoot.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story, through the chair. Representative Carrick, I had a couple of questions. As far as this idea of using the comprehensive plan of a community, on page 4 of the bill, on line 2, it talks about, unless the project is to be located in the unorganized borough, obtain a certified copy of a resolution of the governing body. In my mind, if you have a comprehensive plan, it would not be difficult to then also make a resolution. So in my mind, would that cover that idea of wanting to align with a comprehensive plan for a project? I'm a little bit in the weeds here, but...
Through the chair to Representative Hemshoot, probably. I think, again, a lot of what's in the legislation is policy calls in terms of what our intent is, mm-hmm. and therefore establishing what would actually take place. I think through the existing language in the legislation, we would probably be covering comprehensive planning at the local level, but perhaps that's an area where we could make it more clear what we're looking for.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thanks. And I'm embarrassed to admit I can't remember if it's only first-class cities that have a comprehensive plan or if also second- and third-class cities do. I can't remember. So my next question is about... ADA itself has a really long history, has done some great things in our state. Do you know of a time or at a point at which ADA was reviewed in this way, that the original structures of ADA were amended or reviewed? What you're trying to do here is fairly comprehensive, and so has that been done before?
I'm going to ask my staff to try to take a stab at that, but that would probably, through the chair to Representative Hemshoot, also be a great question for ADA when they're presenting to us next week.
Thank you for the record, Stuart Relay, staff Representative Carrick. In my research, I would say that there were some reforms in the 80s relating to ADA bonding, and they can speak more to those, but that per my research, was the last kind of big reform, and I think that just expanded bonding capacity.
Okay, final follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story. Through the chair, my last question is about the other corporations. I have not thoroughly read the ADA statute, but it's the only corporation that has to return a dividend, or do the other corporations have to? As an economic the function of ADA is economic development, and that is to be shared back with the state. Does the railroad have to share back?
Through the chair to Representative Hemshoot, I believe, but I would have to double check, that ADA is the only state corporation required to share a dividend back.
Okay. Thank you.
Rep. Vance.
Thank you. I'm trying to understand your motivation and the goal of this bill. Because a few years ago, there was a bill having to deal with ADA and the controversy around the public process and always going into executive session and things like that. And I see components of that in this bill. I was supportive of that. My community has said, hey, we need to do things better. We're not getting the transparency and the communication with ADA. So I'm interested in improving that. But I see this bill, to me, gives a perception of wanting to micromanage ADA to where they're no longer an autonomous corporation. And it makes it look like it's anti-economic development. And I don't want to assume that I know what your motivation is. So if you could help me with that and what your end goal is because if it was about creating a clearer public process and transparency that makes better engagement with ADA, I can get on board with that. And I think a lot of people can because they weren't allowing public testimony, right? Simple things like that that we've taken for granted here. So if you could help me see where you're going with this and just the level of detail that feels like overregulation to me. Mm-hmm. Help me understand the motivation and what your end goal is through this legislative process.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Vance, I really appreciate that question. I'm just kind of pulling up my documents again. You know, when I look at the mission statement of ADA, which I just wanted to pull up again so I didn't misstate it, it's promoting, developing, and advancing economic growth and diversification in Alaska through its finance and investment mechanisms. And I think House Bill 124 is, first of all, a starting point. It's not necessarily my intention that exactly what the legislation says and looks like today is what it would look like after hearing from my peers and colleagues about how we strike a better balance. But you're correct that there certainly has been a lot of public pushback on, in particular, some of those very hot-button issue topics for ADA. So I'd like to elevate the good, very heavily supported work that ADA does across the state, while also not ignoring people's concerns about transparency, communication, ability to weigh in on that process, and to have these very large projects have an opportunity for some additional scrutiny. You know, at the end of the day, the projects that ADA works on impact a large number of communities in a lot of cases. One project can touch on 7 or 8 communities in one place. And I think that having a better balance between allowing some of those projects to go forward with scrutiny and just letting status quo, where there are a lot of executive sessions, there is a lack of ability for the public to really weigh in during their processes. And there's just kind of a black box of ADA's doing economic development over here, and the legislature is, on the other hand, considering a lot of the same factors around the same projects. But there's not that really strong two-way street of, you could call it oversight, but also just accountability to each other. What is ADA doing for the state of Alaska? What can we be doing for them? So my intention is to put out a bill that helps to begin a conversation around better striking the balance. And in whatever capacity this committee or throughout the legislative process we decide that should look like, I'm definitely very open to changing and having discussion around making this even stronger legislation to get to that intent.
Rep. McCabe.
Thanks. Yeah, so my staff did a little research in this time of budgetary issues with, I mean, we all know it. We're dealing with it. We're going to see it happen in real time in the next 4 months, you and I and everybody in this building. ADA has returned almost $500 million since 1996 to the state. We just fought a floor fight on a veto override that would be a tenth of that. So we're looking for revenue. Seems to me we may have found it in ADA if we just let them alone and let them do their thing. So I guess my question is, would you be supportive? I know that Fairbanks is looking for a gas line spur, 43 miles, I think, right? So almost nobody in the state would be able, no construction company would be able to build that on their own without some sort of a loan or funding. And I'm wondering if ADA wouldn't be a good spot for that. I mean, you had a slide up there. I used to work for Island Air Service. Mm-hmm. Big Lake Lions Club is the Big Lake. That's our community center in Big Lake. And I like to drink beer, so Alaska Brewing. I mean, you know, so it seems to me ADA funds a lot of projects that people in Alaska need and like. And I'm just wondering if you think that your bill would prevent ADA from helping to fund the spur line that we're discussing that Fairbanks would love to see coming off of the natural gas pipeline to provide natural gas to all of Fairbanks and solve all the EPA problems, or some of them.
At least some of them, right? Through the chair to Representative McCabe, you know, nothing in House Bill 124 says that these projects wouldn't go forward. It just requires additional oversight. So with the Fairbanks spur line, I think ADA could be a great investment opportunity for making that happen, should it not have any other mechanism to go forward. And that is a real huge community issue. There would be a lot of stakeholders impacted. I think when you look at these list of projects existing or projected for ADA, you see a lot of extremely beneficial projects around the state. So again, it, I think, goes back to Representative Holland's earlier question of at what threshold, when the public is asking for additional legislative oversight and public communication from ADA, at what threshold do we decide is qualifying as a project worth our extra look into? And $10 million is a starting place, but for a project the size of the spur line, maybe that's a threshold we want to make sure is underneath where we require that legislative scrutiny. That's really a policy call for this committee and the legislature to take a look at.
One final follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thanks. So the other thing that concerns me is the requirements for a person from an environmental organization on the board. So I'm wondering if that I'm not sure what's driving that, because every ADA project that they have done so far to date has followed every single environmental protection, whether it be a environmental assessment or a full-blown NEPA. They follow all of those laws. So I guess I'm unclear of why we would put an environmental person designated as that on the board to further hamstring ADA or to provide some sort of a board level oversight for environmentals when it's already in regulation. I'm just curious what the thinking is on that.
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, that addition was at the direct request of a lot of constituents to make sure that that was a part of this kind of reform package. But, you know, I might object to the assertion that the addition of an environmental stakeholder would automatically be a hamstring mechanism. I mean, it's very possible that there's many projects in the state that are not going forward because you don't have that additional breadth of experience. It could be. I don't know for sure. But I know that in the Fairbanks area, we had the Delta Wind Farm. It had a whole lot of other extenuating circumstances. It was finally approved just this last fall for work from Golden Valley Electric Association. There's a power purchase agreement that's finally in place. I wonder if having an environmental advocacy organization person wouldn't help to spur additional energy investment in areas maybe we're not taking a look at right now. And as we heard today at a lunch I think many of us were at, energy is additive in this state. We do need to have folks looking at a variety of different industries and innovation opportunities and projects. And so, you know, that is my perspective on why it would be beneficial.
Thank you. Rep. Holland.
Great. Thanks. I had two areas I wanted to touch on. I suspect one or both of them may be things just to kind of get started on and come back to later or perhaps next week. The first one is, you know, I think we've recognized and you've recognized in your presentation the important fiscal contribution that ADA has made through their dividends over the years, I think a half a billion dollars or so. And at this point in time, I believe their assets total about $1.7 billion on their balance sheet right now. And if we were to look at ADA in a percent of market value type of lens that we now use when we look at our other major investment, a percent of market value at 5% would suggest that a dividend might look like 5%, which would be about $70 million. And I think this year it's planned to be a little under $20 million. And I believe the statutes right now give the ADA board a range that they can decide how much of their net profit they would issue as a dividend to the state between, I think, 25 and 50% of their net income. And I look at that, and it's substantially less than what a percent of market value amount might be, about a third. And so that's a roundabout way of asking, but maybe posing for later exploration, what do you see in the process of that dividend decision-making process might be improved on with this look at the ADA management? And is that an opportunity we should be looking at given the financial situation of the state right now? And we need, as fiduciaries of the state, be kind of diligent in looking at all the places we've got money squirreled away and putting to work and asking the question, you know, is the current dividend decision-making process serving us the way it can for the balance that we need to strike between them using their $1.7 billion, and it's been growing, versus a little more of that money flowing into the state for its use. Any thoughts on the dividend as a component of this look at ADA that you're proposing?
Through the chair to Representative Holland, definitely very open to considering it. The one thing that is important to me, though, is just making sure that it is a sustainable draw. We are going to look at the dividend through ADA and consider changing how that works, you know, same as we have with the current percent of market value draw in the Permanent Fund Corporation. Just want to make sure that that's something that's sustainable to continuing to have the same level of investment going forward.
Great. Thanks. Follow-up then?
Follow-up.
Great. So we'll like to explore that later. I want to go off, though, in a slightly different direction from my last area of beginning this discussion that we'll have. The bill at this point suggests a fairly substantial divestment by ADA of its current assets. I believe right now, again, it's about $1.7 billion in assets. I believe the bill would limit that to a half a billion or $500 million, which means they will be potentially asked to divest of two-thirds of their current portfolio, $1 billion. I'm wondering if we have or if we can get some more clarity on what is in that portfolio, what projects are involved, how is that money currently obligated, how is it deployed and invested, what is its liquidity, what is its maturity, so that we could begin to kind of understand what's there. Because I guess from some standpoint, there's two sides of my interest. One is, if we are going to go down this path of divesting it, we should be able to know what it is we might be asking them to divest. And in doing that, we might decide, well, maybe they should keep it, and it may be more valuable for them to continue that investment. On the other hand, I'm interested in some more clarity on where are those investments going, because as somebody who works very actively in the early stage ecosystem of starting businesses, we have a grave problem of not having access to money. And I thoroughly appreciate some of the programs we have for loan guarantees, but that makes the huge assumption that there's somebody willing to write the loan in order to guarantee it. And we don't have enough money at the early stage for getting out there. So I'm kind of interested in understanding what is in this portfolio, what would be the impact of asking them to divest it, what's in there. And maybe in seeing what's in there, we might also have some more clarity on the impact that it's having and maybe some of the opportunities that we might look at some of their statutory funds and programs to decide, are those still the right ones? And I'm looking at areas in housing, energy, and climate community resilience that we need to find ways to support that work. So long-winded way of saying, what do we know now about how the ADA assets are funded, and do we have access to that information? Maybe we can get more.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Holland. Again, great questions for when ADA is before us. This is not information that's just easily, readily available, and it would be really great to have them talk to us here in committee, but also to, through the discussion process on the legislation, provide perhaps some additional information for committee members. So we'll definitely take a note of those questions.
Great. Thank you for that. Sorry for the Kai question.
Was that a question? Was that a question?
But no, that was not a follow-up. Sorry, through the chair, I've sometimes been accused of asking Kai questions. I think it's a derogatory comment when it's made, but I was making it for myself to cut off anybody.
Well, I just wanted to comment and didn't have questions right now to share, but I wanted to comment. Thank you, Rep. Carrick, for bringing us this bill before us, because I think, like all of you, we want to make sure that all the entities that we work with are sound and there's public confidence in them. And like Rep. Vance and Rep. Carrick, I have had comments and emails from people concerned about the lack of public process and how can that be improved. And I've also received emails saying that in recent years, the jobs that are being created are not as many as people thought they were to be. There's been some economic reports on it. And I know Moody downgraded Ada's credit rating due to what they said was a lack of transparency in 2019. And so I think that, you know, those are things that I think it's good to look at this process and see what we might want to do for oversight and just good questions to ask, because we want to work closely with Ada. And I do think about the board of directors. I think in building public confidence in this entity, it might be good to expand who was on the board, because you have various backgrounds on the board. And I think that when they're choosing projects and working, I just think that, again, building public confidence in our entities is something that is always good to strive for in whatever agency we're working with. So I just thought there were great questions today, and I appreciate that, and I look forward to the bill being before us again. And so let's see. We are going to take a brief at ease, and then I'll hand the gavel back to Rep. Carrick and Mr. Relay.
House State Affairs is back on the record. Thank you, Vice Chair Story, for chairing. This concludes our business today. Our next meeting is on Tuesday, January 27 at 3:15 p.m. The agenda for the hearing on Tuesday is as follows. We will take up the ADA Accountability Act, House Bill 124, from my office again for a second hearing. Just for members' information, my intention is to hear this bill twice next week, so we won't be setting an amendment deadline at the next hearing, but we will be hearing from Ada. We will also be having a reintroduction of Representative Nelson, David Nelson's Marijuana Conviction Records Bill, House Bill 81, and having a first hearing on House Bill 202 from Representative Johnson on establishing a state vegetable. With no other business before the committee, State Affairs is adjourned at 4:42.